This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Screen Talk with me, Dan Clark. I think this is number 10. Is it 10? We've hit double figures. Wow. This is not quite Marc Maron's 701, but we'll get there. We'll get there. I'm actually going to retire on 15. Now, I've got to admit, I've been very bad at my job this past week or so. I went away and I didn't take any kind of... I took my phone with me, but I didn't take any other kind of digital device. I had a digital detox, or tried to. Doctor's orders, I've got this silly frozen shoulder thing, which, by the way, if anyone else has this problem, please tweet me at DanClarkESQ, because I want to know what other people have done to get over it, because it's a real problem. But I thought maybe it's because I write all the time. I'm on my computer a lot. Yes, there's opportunities there for masturbation jokes, but it is nothing to do with that, I promise. It's just being tense and writing a lot. So I went away, but it meant I couldn't watch anything. I didn't watch anything for a week, which is probably the longest I haven't watched a TV show or a film in that long. I'm really going to have to rely on our first guest today to give me a lot of material with film news and reviews. That'll be James Gill. After our first song, which is from one of my favourite films. It's a hard film to watch, this Magnolia, because it's so melodramatic.
Oh my God, mate, one of my favourites. What a movie.
There you go. James Gill is in the studio, in case you couldn't... in case you're wondering who that was, or whether that's my other voice.
Where would you put that in the all-time?
In the all-time?
That might be... That's top 20, I reckon. Tom Cruise... Not winning an Oscar for Magnolia still keeps me awake at night.
What, supporting actor?
He was nominated. Amazing. It's one of the finest performances I've ever seen. And Michael Caine, we all love Michael Caine, but Michael Caine winning for the Cider House Rules.
Geez.
Good night, you. I mean, what accent is he doing? Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England.
He's doing, I think he's doing Sid James's accent before he'd gone full Cockney. Because it's sort of a bit South African.
It's everywhere.
Everywhere.
I mean, Kane is amazing, but Cruise in that movie.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I when people accuse Cruise of not being a great actor.
Cruise is a great actor.
He is a great actor. Yes, he's not a character actor. People get those two things always mixed up. A character actor and a movie star don't necessarily... One isn't better than the other. They're both two very, very different things and both equally brilliant. But he has range. And when you watch him in that film, he is... just absolutely mind-blowing.
Cruise could end up being a wonderful character actor the older he gets.
Yeah,
he's got that talent.
But he's still desperate to do action films at the moment.
The guy will be a movie star for many more years.
I think he's the... we've gone totally off subject here.
But Cruise!
I'm going to do this because, look, yes, he's got a questionable personal life with some of the stuff that he believes in or whatever.
Nothing to do with his ability as an actor.
Nothing to do. If we can separate the artist and the person.
This is gold, by the way.
Separate the artist and the person, which is something you want to talk about after our first song, by the way. So this is light by comparison.
Oh, yes.
But if you can separate the artist from the person, I'm a big Cruise fan and a champion of him as an actor. And I just wish he would go back to doing some more, sort of mix it up with a few more interesting projects. So it isn't just all the Mission Impossibles and Day After Tomorrows and things. What was that one called?
I mean, that was awesome.
The Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Which was great, but I want another Magnolia.
Another Magnolia thrown in the mix.
Yeah, just thrown in there.
Tom, if you're listening.
Tom, I know you love this show, so please, come on, man. Just do one of those. But yeah, his performance in Magnolia is great. I love that film so much. But it is it's not one that you just flick on a Sunday, because there's so much crying
absolutely.
And pain in that film.
And it's 8 weeks long.
And it is 8 weeks long. But there is. Have you watched the director's cut, which is 2 months long?
I'm not sure.
No, there isn't a director's cut. But it would be that long if there was. This is the opening song from the film, which a lot of the songs are by Amy Mann, and this is one.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know.
Is it going to end? Or will it stay on this one chord for the rest of our lives?
There is a director's cut of this song that goes on for the rest of our lives.
James Gill with us. James Gill, film editor from Shortlist.
Shortlist. The best magazine on the planet.
Yes.
Wow, thank you for allowing me that plug.
Yeah. Which is a weird thing to plug, considering it's a free magazine.
My boss will be delighted that I crowbarred that in. Thank you.
Okay, great. James, we were texting this morning about stuff we're going to talk about news-wise, and you wanted to discuss some slightly weightier film news.
Should we go weighty first?
Yeah, I think we should go weighty, because let's end on a light note before we bring our guests in. And
so a topic came up at Shortlist yesterday, and it was Ronan Farrow has written an eviscerating essay for The Hollywood Reporter, mm-hmm. where he is supporting his sister Dylan. They are the children of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen, and Dylan has she came out a few years ago to say that her father Woody Allen had allegedly sexually abused her. Ronan Farrow has previously supported her with a blog post. However, this piece, if you haven't read it, on The Hollywood Reporter, please do read it. He's a beautiful writer. He's a reporter. It's a fantastic piece. And it's him. It's not just him going for Woody Allen. It's also him making a point about the press. So the old guard of the press would often leave these things well alone. They wouldn't dare to ask these questions of these stars accused of certain things for fear of burning bridges with publicists and therefore burning bridges with other stars. And Ronan Farrow is making the point that times are changing. We've seen it with the Cosby, what happened there with Hannibal Buress, a fellow comedian. And we are starting to see it with Alan. And then what was interesting was that the piece last night was retweeted and shared by the likes of Sarah Silverman and the likes of Judd Apatow. So this piece really has blown up. And it's such a hot topic because, on one hand, Woody Allen is one of the greatest directors of all time, responsible for, I mean, films like Annie Hall and Manhattan. These are timeless pieces of work. However,
and Match Point.
I quite like Match Point, you know. However, these accusations, and I need to be careful how I phrase this legally, are pretty much as bad as it can get.
So, just so for people that don't know exactly what the allegations are, and they are allegations at this point, it's that he... Did he repeatedly, or was
yes,
it a one-off?
Yes, so Mia Farrow had come out a few years ago to say that this had happened. And there was a tension at the time. And in the end, because the girl was so young, Farrow actually withdrew her from the spotlight because she was being a mum. Yeah. She was worried that it was taking her toll on her daughter. Ronan Farrow is now 28, which is perhaps why he feels... I mean, the piece is wonderful because he's also criticising himself. I think he feels that in the past he could have done more about certain things. He, as a reporter, once interviewed someone who'd written a biography about Bill Cosby, and he felt that he should have pressed the guy more, and he didn't. So I guess he's saying to all of us that there needs to be greater responsibility in these. Woody Allen still attracts incredible talent, and I guess Farrow is also perhaps questioning whether these... A-listers, let's be honest, if you look at the people who still work with Alan, you're talking about people at the peak of their powers. He's questioning whether these people should be queuing up to appear in Alan's movies.
See, I mean, it's a really tricky one for me because I desperately want to work with him. No, I don't want it to be true because he is one of my film heroes. But, you know...
I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? We all sort of wish it wasn't true. However, I do urge you, dear listener, to please check out Ronan Farrow's piece because he puts together quite the case.
Well, the thing is at this stage, it's like the Michael Jackson thing. You know, it is literally one person's word against another, or in Jackson's case, two people's word against another person's. And until you really, really know. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to... Who knows what... You just don't know what's going on. I know that you're saying that he's put forward an amazing case, but the thing is it's like... It's such a conflicting thing because in the... I think it's worse. What was worse was the Roman Polanski thing because he was actually proved to be guilty.
Yes.
He was guilty.
Yes.
Factually guilty. Yep. It isn't like one person saying one thing, another person saying... He was actually guilty. He fled. I'm a huge Roman Polanski fan.
Yeah.
I'm also a believer of, like, you know, do we... if the victim of the Roman Polanski crime doesn't want anything to happen. She was saying, look, I just want it to be left alone. I don't want to go through all that stuff. So do you respect the wishes of the victim? Do you respect the wishes of the law? But he was actually guilty, and yet people still work with him. And when you listen to the transcription of what he did, it's horrific.
I think
now he had a horrible, horrible life. I mean, the guy fled Nazis when he was a child. His parents were, you know, his whole family were killed by the Manson family. You know, like, he's obviously a troubled guy,
yeah.
And you can't use that as an excuse. But in this case, this is in some respects worse than Cosby or Allen because he's actually guilty.
I also think we let the enormity of the talent sometimes get in the way. So in this country, when it's been like, let's be honest, naff 70s DJs,
yeah.
we're all instantly throwing the book at them.
Yeah, can you separate?
Whereas because we're talking about some of the greatest talents of recent popular culture, Cosby, Allen, Polanski.
Yeah.
That often clouds our judgment, which is totally wrong.
But there are people. There must be people in history, you know, the Mozarts and Beethovens, who probably did horrible things. But like their work now is what we know. We don't know what they did in their.
Whereas
personal
I think that's
lives.
Important. What Ronan Farrow has done in that case to blow the whistle and attract so much attention, so that from now on, I mean, I personally, crikey, dare I say it, I won't. I look at the work of Woody Allen differently now.
Yeah. Well, some people point out some of his films that have him in relationships with younger people and go, well, that's a bit weird, isn't it?
That one with Charlize Theron, isn't there?
Well, in Manhattan is the main
Manhattan,
one.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, can you, you know, when you talk about separating the genius artist and the man himself, can you do that with Saville?
But, I mean, that's a prime example because he was such a, you know, buffoonish
is that a bad
character.
Joke?
It is in a way. Well, yeah, it is, given what we're talking about. I mean, hang on, you're a comedian. You've got to make a joke about anything. You know, there's no. I'm not drawing a line or anything.
I'm making more of a joke about the fact that what he offered culturally was nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's so, like you're saying, so much easier to hate. Well, like, I mean, obviously,
there's no
what
hurdle
he did.
To those guys.
Yeah,
there's no because no the hurdle. Talent because the talent. Let's be honest, wasn't there.
Yeah.
So there's no barrier to overcome. It's easier to go for them. But because the hurdle of talent with Allen and Polanski and Cosby is so high, that's the thing that we as a society have struggled to overcome.
Well, like I say, I want it to not be true. I'm going to read this article because, you know, I'm not just because I don't want it to be true. I'm not going to ignore everything that's out there. But, you know, it would be awful. It would be awful because of how much he's influenced me as a writer, performer, film lover, you know.
You cannot understate the influence that Alan has had on films and comedy. I mean, even to this day, there are still people still do routines that are so similar to Alan's stand-up. You know, I recently saw a variation on the, you know, the gag where the punchline is Alan was looking in a mirror the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I still see Axe on the Circuit doing.
Do you?
Use it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, wow. And it turned out it was a mirror. You're like, that is a 50-year-old joke.
Well, there's also people making Woody Allen-esque movies as well.
Absolutely.
Still, you know. Well, should we move on to something a bit lighter?
Well, yes. I wish I had a segue, but I do not. It would appear that it's not just movies getting rebooted as movies. Now movies are getting rebooted as TV shows, or that trend is continuing, because both Lethal Weapon and The Exorcist are now becoming TV shows.
And before that, we've already had, like, 12 Monkeys.
Yes.
We've had... They tried Zombieland, they tried...
Zombieland is a puzzler, because that, it would appear, would make a great TV show. And the pilot was okay, wasn't it, by all accounts? Because the film is brilliant. It's a treat.
Brilliant.
And they're making the sequel this year, I believe, aren't they?
Brilliant film.
So for whatever reason, sometimes when they try a movie as a TV show, it just... I mean, look at MASH. That's probably the most successful example of all time, isn't it? So yes, we've got Damon Wayans as Murtaugh, which it seems great casting.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love Damon Wayans? And then it's a character actor called Clayne Crawford from Rectify is taking on the role of Riggs, who is a former Navy SEAL.
Now, really, when you strip away Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, and it's a show about a white cop and a black cop, is that still Lethal Weapon? I mean, what makes it Lethal Weapon?
Because of the backstory of Riggs, I guess, because he's the unhinged maverick. I think his wife died in the films, whereas in this, I think it's his wife and I believe his daughter. So he's still the Lethal Weapon. He's still unhinged.
Right.
In this, he's a former Navy SEAL. So, you know, in the movies...
Was he a Vietnam vet?
He was a Vietnam vet in the original.
But surely in this day and age, they wouldn't... let a lethal weapon on the police force? Wouldn't there be health and safety regulations?
Now, that would be a rubbish program.
excuse me, can I just point out that...
Yeah, I'd like to be a cop. I'm afraid you're too unhinged. End credits.
That'd be brilliant. A 10-minute episode. Yeah. No more.
That's it, yeah.
Thank you for watching Lethal Weapon. There will be no more.
And The Exorcist.
The Exorcist. Gina Davis... Is appearing in the Exorcist TV
appearing
show.
Appearing in it.
Appearing. I think that
will she be in it as a regular?
She'll be in it. Yeah. I think she's in it regular. I've said on this show before that I sometimes worry when an actor or actress who we haven't seen for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure they're perfectly happy. I mean, she's a very good archer, isn't she? Tried to make the US Olympic team. But I'll be walking down the street to a supermarket and I think, oh God, I've not seen such and such in a film for a while. I hope they're all right.
Yeah.
So when I saw Gina Davis, I was like, oh great, Gina's in The Exorcist.
I agree with you. I was listening to an Alec Baldwin podcast and he was interviewing Kathleen Turner, and she sort of quit because she had chronic arthritis or something,
right.
And she had to focus on being a mum for a while, and then when you're out of the game for a bit, I guess for a woman it's even harder as well. And it's weird. It's like, wow, she was in some of the biggest films in the 80s.
Absolute 80s icon.
Yeah, and she was amazing. And, you know,
she was
these
fantastic.
People,
she such was charisma. And then when she came back as Chandler's...
Mum-dad. Yeah.
I mean, she was fantastic.
And what a bold thing to do.
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
Play a post-op.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. And she... my girlfriend had never seen War of the Roses, so I made her watch it the other day, and it is a... fucking brilliant.
Does it still hold up?
It still holds up.
Not seen it for years.
Completely. Not as good as Romancing the Stone.
Do you follow Michael Douglas on Facebook?
I don't.
Please do.
Oh, God.
Michael Douglas. We all love Michael Douglas.
We love Douglas.
But Douglas is a bit of a... I would love to meet Michael Douglas, so I don't want to... I don't like criticising anyone. If you're a regular listener, you will know that I am Johnny Positive.
Yeah.
But he's responsible for some of the most beautiful humble brags on Facebook. So one of them the other day was, it was so wonderful to see my old co-star, Annette Bening, again. And you think, oh, this is nice. This is lovely from Michael. And then it was, as she presented me with a medal for being awesome. And it was like, oh, Michael.
There's a medal for that?
Yeah, yes,
for
there
being
is.
Awesome?
Yes.
Well, I enjoy Stallone's Twitter or Instagram feed, because it's basically him taking pictures of him with other famous actors.
Right, okay.
It's almost like he's not famous himself. Like he's just some
he's not aware
boy.
That he's an icon of America.
Yeah, yeah. What other news do we have?
So the first trailer for Assassin's Creed is out with the Fass. Michael Fassbender is leading us. I tell you what, the trailer looks awesome. I've had a good think about this, and I can't think of a single video game to movie transfer that has really done the business.
Yeah, well, other than Super Mario Brothers.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a given.
just thinking about that, like, Bob Hoskins as the Super Mario Brothers. Have you ever seen that film?
Not all the way through.
No, no.
It's practically unwatchable.
Before you talk about the trailer, because I'm not a game person.
It looks pretty faithful to the games.
And what is the game?
The game is
it's kind of martial art.
It's quite the storyline is slightly complicated. So you go to like a facility where your memories of an ancestor are transferred into you, and you travel back in time to fight crime. And there's lots of jumping off high ledges. That is what that's the trademark of the game, really. These super slow-mo long dives off the top of buildings. And then the final shot of the trailer is Fassbender pulling off one of these iconic plunges off the top of a tower. So it does look like I would describe the trailer as a cross between Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven and a Bourne movie. There's lots of awesome hand-to-hand combat and jumping about and diving, and it's got that epic, dirty, gritty feel of Kingdom of Heaven, which even if you didn't like the film, I thought still looked beautiful.
Well, I look forward to that now. Who's directed that?
I don't know. Michael Fassbender. I always make lots of notes for appearing on Dan's show. I'm looking at them now, and that is a gaping omission.
Oh dear.
Well, to end on a light note, there is a pretty laughable conspiracy theory doing the rounds that Disney pay off journalists to give all the Disney movies awesome reviews and rival movies bad reviews. For example, the theory there is a petition that you can sign. What will this petition achieve? I don't know. Their theory is that Disney pay off journalists to give the Marvel Cinematic Universe films really strong reviews, and then other superhero movies not so good reviews.
And do you believe this?
Well, as someone who has reviewed many Disney superhero movies and rival superhero movies, I would like to know where the Disney money is, please, because I haven't received a penny.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Do you think they... do you think they're concerned about your reviews? Or that's not... I don't mean that in an offensive
thanks,
way,
Dan.
But do you think Disney are like, James, listen, we got to get a briefcase to James Gill.
I would say that
because in a world where word of mouth and internet promotion is key now, what kind of reviews are we talking?
I think they're talking all reviews everywhere. So the main example, I guess, is the reviews of Batman and Superman, which I really enjoyed, but obviously I'm the only person on planet Earth. Well, the theory goes that now you'd be paid to give, say, Guardians of the Galaxy and Civil War and Iron Man, etc. You'd be paid
bad
off
reviews.
To give... No, awesome reviews. It's Disney who are doing the paying.
Yeah.
So therefore, they'd get the with me because Disney own Marvel.
Oh, of course they do, yes. Wow.
I shouldn't have brought this up, have I?
No, but I don't know. It's just, there's so much corruption in the world. It's like, where isn't it happening?
Well, it's my understanding that it isn't happening in film reviews.
Okay, good. Is there, what film has sparked this current theory?
Well, the reason why it's resurfaced is because of the reviews of X-Men Apocalypse, which...
Mixed.
They've been mixed. Yeah. They have been mixed. Yes.
Ah. So, obviously, it's Disney.
Exactly! I mean, who else can it be? I'm seeing it Monday. I love Bryan Singer. I love the X-Men movies. I got to speak with one of the stars of X-Men Apocalypse. It's out in next week's shortlist. Out Thursday.
Are you going to tell us?
I think it's I better not say, just in case, that it's a big reveal, because it's a big star. Someone you and I both love a great deal.
Oh, good.
And he was...
Michael Douglas.
Awesome.
I didn't know he was in it.
That's a big reveal. Michael Douglas comes back as Wolverine.
Oh, that would be good.
I'd watch that.
With big grey sideburns.
I would watch that, yeah.
Well, thank you, James. Always a pleasure to have you on.
God bless you, my friend.
Next week, can we talk about something even heavier?
Yes.
If that's possible.
Is that possible?
About I don't know, the problem with paedophilia in Hollywood or something.
Wow.
No, I don't know. I was actually watching a Corey Feldman interview a couple of weeks ago where he sort of allured to the fact that this is an issue. I'm like, God, it's nothing sacred. Not that I thought Hollywood was sacred, but do you know what I mean? It's like,
what was he alleging?
That happened within the system.
Well, I look forward to talking about this in detail.
No, we're not going to talk about it. I think it was just, you know, endemic of that era, the 70s and 80s. There was a lot of dodgy men in those two decades.
It's staggering, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just, you know, if I was 60 now, I'd be terrified that someone's going to knock on my door and arrest me any minute, because you were obviously like 20 in the 70s when it was okay to do certain things. I mean, it's awful.
I want to know more.
Well, no, I didn't do anything.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought we were going to get a FUBAR exclusive there. No. Wow, incredible.
I was actually not born for most of the 70s and a child, so it would have been really difficult for me to do stuff.
Dan, thank you for having me.
No,
as
it's
always
been a pleasure. Thanks, we're going to play our first song from our next guests. This is My Rifle, My Pony and Me by Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson.
The sun is sinking in the west. The cattle go down to the stream. The red wing settles in her nest. It's time for a cowboy to dream. Purple light in the canyon. That's where I long to be. With my three good companions, just my rifle, pony, and me. Gonna hang my sombrero on the limb of a tree. Coming home, sweetheart, darling. My rifle, pony, and me.
Whippoorwill in the willow sings a sweet melody.
Riding to Amarillo,
Amarillo.
Just my rifle, pony, and me.
No more cow,
no more cow
to be roping,
to be roping.
No more stray,
no more stray.
Will I see
round the bend,
round the bend?
She'll be waiting,
she'll be waiting
for my rifle, pony, and me. For my rifle, my pony. And me.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
So that was George's choice.
Yeah.
Why did you pick that song?
I just think it's a lovely song.
Yeah, but from a film. Which film was
it's
that from?
Rio Bravo.
Rio Bravo, of course.
Which,
classic.
It's a classic. It's not one of my. I mean, I like it, but I wouldn't put it in my top 10. But it's just a lovely moment in the film where it's that sort of. They often have it in action films where it's that little break in the action and they all kind of just sit around and
it's quite a Western thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes you find out a bit more about the characters, or but in this one they just sing a nice little song.
Wasn't there a TV show called Rio Bravo about a police force or something?
Ooh.
In the 80s, so. No. Can we Google that? So, with us in the studio now, we are very lucky to have George Jeffrey and Bert Tyler Moore. Could you just say hello and say your name so that people can distinguish the difference?
I'm George Jeffrey. I could thick Scottish accent.
Yeah.
I'm George Jeffrey.
And that makes you...
I'm Bert, the one who was just talking about Dean Martin.
And Bert, are you related to Mary?
No, it's a made-up showbiz name.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
Hey, you fell for it.
No, I fell for it, but also I love it because I always wanted to do that when I was younger and for some reason didn't have the courage.
Well, see, my real name is Dave Turner.
No way.
Dave Turner.
I like
but I
that.
Thought, because I used to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
So I thought when I started doing that, I need a bit of a kind of a showbizy name. And also it's the sort of hangover of punk when everyone made up names like Elvis Costello.
And it also confused the DHSS. somewhat.
Yeah. More to the point, yeah.
And a sort of John Cooper Clarke sort of esque name. Do you feel like
do you think
the three...
Is that his real name,
John Cooper? No, but that's what I'm saying. Like, maybe he didn't...
No, it was the Elvis Costello theory, which was obviously Elvis is there's only one Elvis.
Yeah.
And I thought there's only one Tyler Moore.
Yeah.
Mary Tyler Moore.
Is this a football chant? Well, we should inform our listeners of exactly what kind of work you guys have been up to as a duo and separately. Your writing credits include, this is a long list, this is just some of the stuff you've done, Psycho Bitches.
It's all as a duo, sorry, I should say.
Is it all as a duo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Psycho Bitches, Harry and Paul, The Kumars, Tracy Ullman Show, Full Britannia, Armstrong and Miller Show, In With The Flynns, Mitchell and Webb Look, My Family, Dame Edna, Alan Carr, Big Train, Lenny Henry. I'm sure there's ones that you've not been credited as well.
Yes, there'd be a few, but I don't know what they are.
And then, of course, you co-created and wrote the very popular Star Stories and currently have the new comedy The Windsors are on Channel 4, which is going out what days of the week?
Friday nights at 10.
The classic slot back in the day. Does it mean anything anymore, the Friday night slot? Does it... It used to be.
Well, we didn't particularly want to get in that slot because I think there is quite a lot of comedy that normally is on there, and we didn't really want to go up against it, or we wanted to slip out at sort of 2 a.m. on a Tuesday. But
wow, you are ambitious. You are. I know what you mean, though. There's sometimes shows that are found by the audience are sort of they feel like they're more beloved in a way because they have that kind of ownership.
Than
when it's been thrust upon people, you know?
But in a way, I can understand why they've done it, because, it is the royal family, so in a way you can't really sneak that under the net. It's so sort of...
No, it's got Harry Enfield in it and stuff. And,
It kind of reminds me a bit of a royal family version of Star Stories. Do you feel like that's a fair... observation?
It's got a lot of the sort of attitude of Star Stories, but the actual format's... quite different, really, because it is a soap opera, this Windsors, whereas that was a little doco film of George Michael's life, and had a voiceover, and you would just jump around for the funniest bits and just
I feel like I can see your voice in that compared to, say, something like Pete versus Life, which is another of your shows that you co-created.
Yes,
that felt like, I guess it's because it is taking, you know, a bit of a swipe at people that we know and that currently exist as well.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and I think as well, in both Star Stories and The Windsors, there's a looseness in that you can be silly and go off at little tangents and, it's not sort of slavishly.
No, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, and also it's just sort of our style when we're doing stuff about real people like this who are... They're not evil, but, you know, a bit twatty in a way. Nothing unpleasant, but, you know, deserve a little bit of gentle ribbing. It's just to get to the, you know, the bit that makes them funny or a bit, you know, to be mocked as quickly as possible. Just
how did it come about? How did the idea of doing a kind of... would you say it's a spoof soap? To me, it felt almost... I suppose it's more like a sitcom about the royal family, but imagining them...
Yeah, soap was always a bit, very much a touchstone for it. But if you look at stuff like Kimmy Schmidt or something like that, they'd never claim to be soaps, but they are very soapy. You know, they'll end on longing looks to somebody who's just walked out a door. They'll use all the tricks of soap, but they, you know, they're sitcoms, you know, straight up and down sitcoms, really, yeah.
So where did the idea come from?
It was a chat I was having with the guy who ended up being the executive producer, Robert Wolf Cochrane.
You only work with double barrel people.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, very
little,
much so.
Little private club. yeah, we were just sort of slagging off the royal family, and I think it was probably round about the time of the wedding, and just saying, God, everyone's so respectful, and and one, you know, we just started talking, and one thing led to another, and we just the idea of a. Well, initially I think he was saying, oh, it would be good to do a show, but we couldn't possibly use the real names, could we? And then I was sort of saying, well, you know, we did that in Star Stories.
What is the libel issue? What is the kind of
I think
the legal...
We're at the mercy of their generosity, I think. Actually, I mean, the trick with Star Stories was always, it's either absolutely bang on true, or it's so silly that they'll never bother suing over it. And we ended up having no trouble at all with that. You know, it was either true or too silly. And this, it's little of it is true. It's really, it's all very, very silly.
It would be a bit weird of them to spend a lot of time and money suing you guys. I mean, it'd be great for you guys. It'd be really good publicity.
Yes.
But so if any of you are listening from the royal family...
but I suppose as well, it's the other thing is it's not... It's so removed from what they really are that you know.
Although I think Harry Enfield's interpretation is actually quite accurate.
It's very accurate.
Yeah,
but he can really, if he wants to, he can do an absolutely perfect one. He's doing our characters, we've written him, but if he does his own version of Charles with all Charles's mannerisms, it's absolutely indistinguishable.
Oh, wow.
He's brilliant.
I'd like to see that. So you touched on this notion that you were surprised by people's outpouring of love for the royal family.
Well, I wasn't surprised. It was just like, my God, I'm sick of it.
I was really surprised when the... was it in 2012 or 2011? When was Kate and Will's wedding?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just how it was like, you know, the flags came out and there was a long weekend and people were really... I was actually on tour doing a stand-up tour and I was in somewhere like Buxton or Harrogate or somewhere.
Yeah.
And the whole town was set up and I was like, wow, I thought we'd sort of... You know, gotten over this. I thought this was an 80s thing. Like, what?
Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, polls, you know, they are incredibly popular, but there's a, you know, substantial minority who aren't quite so keen. But
yeah, and I suppose that's going back to the original conversation. That's what we were kind of saying. Isn't it time that substantial minority sort of had a little
are
bit
you,
of a say? You know?
So are you staunchly anti royal family?
Not staunchly. If there was a vote, I know which way I'd vote. But
okay.
You know, they're so entrenched, and I'm sure I feel like lots of people just thought it's not worth worrying about. So my view on it was, you know, they've got a bit of power, they're a bit ridiculous, they're an absolute perfect target for a comedy show, but I wouldn't get my knickers in a twist about it. But
and the important thing as well is the show doesn't have that agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, because if it did, it would be so sort of political and boring.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the show is just meant to be funny and silly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great show. What episode are we on at the moment?
Episode 3 is about to go out on this Friday.
Yes.
And is there any talk of doing more? Yeah. Or is it too early?
Early.
It's gone very well. I mean, the reviews have been good, and the viewing figures are very good. So.
Well, we have a little clip. This isn't something
excellent.
We do very often on this
great.
Show, but we actually have a little clip. So, this is. From episode 3.
A pint of lager, please, mate. Darling?
Snakebite in black.
Excuse me, your highnesses. These are on a house.
Oh, no. We've left the royal family.
Yeah, we're just Wills and Kate, two normal people who happen to live in Rickmansworth.
Oh, right. Well, in that case, it's £8.40.
Ah. Is this one 10 pints?
Yep, that's right.
Actually, it's this one.
Yeah. You think I'd know in my line of work? So you ain't going to be king and queen no more?
Nope, we're just going to be plain old Mr. and Mrs. Windsor, only without the castle. Plain old Mr. and Mrs. Windsor, only without the castle.
Yeah, I...
Oh, my God. People used to laugh just because I was a prince. I'm not the funniest man in the world.
Very funny. Very funny. Weirdly, without the visuals, it almost sounded like The Archers or something.
I know. There are a lot of visual jokes in that piece.
Yeah, it's a weird choice. So you guys have written together... Did you ever write separately, or was it... until you met each other and you're like, hey, I like writing, me too? Or did you put an ad out in the back of...
No, we were both... I used to do stand-up and George was in a double act.
Yeah, and this is sort of in the late 80s and 90s and we became friends and, you know, you have so much spare time being a stand-up. We used to think, oh, you know, we could spend a couple of hours doing some writing a couple of days a week. And we did that and it, you know, sort of took off. Took off's a bit strong, but it gently went up a gradient.
Well, you make a career out of it, so I think that took off. And have you ever written separately, or is it very much...
I've written a few bits and bobs of my own. I mean, before we hooked up, I was always trying to write something or other. But it wasn't really until, you know, the two of us met that it really...
How does it work? Because I write, and I write on my own, and there's a lot of... let's just say a lot of darkness happens that I think if there was one other person, maybe it wouldn't get quite so bad. Like, is that part of the reason you like working together, or is it because one of you has a strength, one of you's good at characters, or one of you's good at plot, or like?
No, it's not that. I think we're both more or less equal at everything, but it's more that there's a sort of a
such a happy democracy.
It's a chemistry. It's a sort of I always forget how to say it. The sum of the parts is great, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. It sort of becomes the combination becomes a different thing, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
but then you, on the downside, you do have to split the money.
That's why I don't do it. Very selfish. But what is your actual process? How do you do it? Do you sit together?
Yeah, we're pretty old-fashioned. We sit in each other's kitchens with a laptop open. I type
always. Does it have to be a kitchen?
It has to be a kitchen.
Yeah, for tea.
It can be a breakfast bar occasionally, but no, mainly it's a kitchen table, and we just thrash it out. That's not very informative, but that's basically how it happens.
But is there ever a moment where one of you is like, do you just get inspiration and you're like, I've got all these ideas, but I can't write until George is here, or I really want to type, but
Idea. We just, you know, I had this thought, you know, yesterday or over the weekend, and you know, that like, you know, indeed the Windsors. I mean, Bert turned up one morning with that and said, you know, I've been having this chat, and what about this? And, you know, so the creative process can happen outside the room, but generally it all gets written down together.
Because when I was in a sketch group years ago, and what
Electric
I found...
Eel.
Electric
yeah,
Eel. Remember well remembered. Well. Wow.
Comedy Nation.
God. Yes, God.
We were on Comedy Nation.
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes.
There you go.
Oh, yes.
Comedy Nation, kids, if you're too young to know, was a show that spawned many legends.
Wasn't Sacha Baron Cohen on it?
He was, yeah. I think Sacha was on it. And
Julia Davis was on it.
Julia Davis, Julian Barrett. Yep. Did The Pod. Do you remember The Pod?
Yes.
Yep.
Which was brilliant. When we used to write together, we used to sometimes spend like an hour debating a character's name.
Oh, yeah, we do that, yeah.
And then when I started writing on my own, I got like 10 pages done in a day. Now, they weren't very good, but I was like, wow, you can get a lot more done. It's just... it needs a lot more work afterwards.
Yeah, it's the rigour goes out of it. Yeah. I find if I ever sit down and try anything on my own, it's, you know, oh, yeah, that'll do for now, and I'll come back and fix that later, and then don't.
So, what about holidays, and, you know, what about if someone's dog's ill? Do you get annoyed with the other one for stuff like that?
They sort of work out, and we're very good at keeping, like, office hours. Well, I say office hours.
Yeah.
Start at 10:30 and finish at 5, usually, but unless there's big pressure... yeah, mm-hmm. to deliver something. But
are you both based in London?
No, we were originally. I mean, we both used to live around here, which is Holloway. I live in Amersham now, and Bert lives in Southwark.
So how do you do that?
It's actually not too bad. It's about an hour and a quarter door to door. So
do you ever Skype your meetings?
No.
Old school.
Very old.
We could do. I mean, and we've Skyped with other people, but it's just. Because I think part of the process is sitting around having a cup of tea and talking about last night's telly, and, you know, and I think that's the same. I think there was a piece on creativity in some magazine, and it's the same with lots of things. Like there used to be the idea that, you know, it's a waste of time to go into an office and have coffee and, you know, water cooler stuff with your colleagues, but actually it's not, because it's part of a creative process, and that's all. Without you really thinking about it, is feeding into stuff that actually ends up being creative.
Where is it? Like Pixar or somewhere where they all just have ping pong tables and you know, bean bags, and you only work when you're inspired. And
yeah, well, that's when it gets a bit arsey. But
well,
I'm
you
sure
say that they've succeeded in making a couple of movies.
True,
There's probably a lot of people that don't really have jobs there. You might be able to just wander in and go, yeah, you know, I designed the legs.
Yeah, that sounds good. Go with that.
So having watched most of your shows, the ones that you created, things like Star Stories and Pete vs. Life, they seem like shows that could have run and run for much longer. Were they, in some instances, were they your choice to come to an end?
No.
Yeah, we'd
still be
crying. Stop crying.
On Star Stories. But I think on Star Stories, we sort of ran out of people to do. They were a really small niche. They had to be young and very popular. And there's really not that many, and they had to have done something. They had to be ridiculous. You know, there's no
point. Had to have had a story like a sex tape or a divorce or something like that. A lot of them hinged on those big moments in people's real lives, didn't they?
Yeah.
And funnily enough, I always thought I'm sure you agree, the older ones that we did were actually more interesting because they had that sort of.
They had a whole
back, I mean, Paul McCartney and Elton John. Mm-hmm. But we could only do them because at the time something tabloidy.
Had
was happening in
right.
their lives.
Like Paul McCartney was getting divorced at the time, so he was right on the front page for a while.
But you could, like now, since... How long ago did it finish?
About 2005.
No, 2008 it finished, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
That is almost... That's 8 years ago. But there's a lot... There's the Kanyes and Kardashians of the world. There's a lot of new people you could do.
Yeah, but I'm not interested in them as like Paul McCartney. You know?
Yeah.
If they made us an offer,
Did you ever do anyone that you were a fan of and you felt guilty about taking the piss out of?
No.
Paul McCartney. I mean, obviously, we're both fans of Paul McCartney, but you know, you can be a fan and think, well, you know, you shouldn't be haggling with taxi drivers and go for a tenner, which is you know, something he allegedly does.
Well, you know, that's terrible. You know, the we were talking about Woody Allen a minute ago or a few minutes back, and. I remember that Paul Kay did Dennis Penis to Woody Allen, and apparently he said, you know, afterwards he said, I felt so awful.
Oh, I think that was Steve Martin.
No, he did also do Woody Allen. Yeah, he did.
Because I know he did Steve Martin and felt terrible about that as well.
But he's actually in a Woody Allen film, Paul Kay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So
does Woody Allen know?
I don't know. I was like, did he get on set and go, look, first things first, I'm really sorry about that joke I did on you back in the 90s. And Woody Allen probably had no idea who he was. So there wasn't anyone that you were like, oh, God, if he watches...
No.
Well, actually, I tell you, I wasn't very happy with was we really took the mickey out of Anton Deck, and our producer put that stuff in, and I really like Anton Deck, and also personally as well, and I always felt slightly bad about that one. Yeah, but that's the only one that springs to mind.
I know quite a lot of the performers in it, and I've been out with one or two of them when they've seen someone that they played. Yeah. Like, I know that Ollie Maltman, who was in the first series, met Sean Pertwee.
Oh, really? What happened?
He just pointed his finger at him.
Oh, my God.
Like in a sort of, you, why I order sort of thing. And I think Noel Gallagher came up to hit Ollie and Kevin one point. And I don't think you ever did Noel Gallagher, did you?
I think
that
they were guest stars.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Tom Meaton played Liam Gallagher, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's right. And he was like, seen you guys. You know. That's a man accent, by the way.
But actually, it was very funny on the pilot of that. It was very hard to get people to be in it because it was, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, you know, you don't want to upset this lot, because it was Natural Nylon, who were the British film industry
that's
at the time, nobody wanted to upset them at all. So I think Rhys Thomas was, you know, not that he wasn't the first choice, but he was brilliant at stepping forward and doing it.
Yeah.
He was great. Played Jude Law.
Yeah, that was the pilot, right? And it was also in the series as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So is there anything you want to crack next? Is TV what you love doing, or is it? Would you like to do film? Is there a West End show, the Bert and George? You do know that you're known as Bert and George, right? That's how you...
Yeah.
You're like, do you not like that?
Perfectly
I don't mind
that.
It.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't, because it's you first.
Bert and George.
And Bert.
I know, but then when you go on a website to look up any information, it's the other way around. So I don't know how...
I think it's all alphabetical. I think Jeffrey comes before Tyler Moore, but and Bert comes before George. But
you sound like artists. You sound like Gilbert and Sullivan or something. or who
Gilbert
are they?
And George.
Gilbert and George, that's who I'm thinking of. Now, moving on to your guilty pleasure, right? Now, you... we do this every week. We ask our guests to pick a guilty pleasure. It could be film or a TV show, but people tend to pick films. Now, you guys picked one each. We can only do one.
Oh.
But I do want to mention quickly your choice. I can't remember who picked Kelly's Heroes.
I picked Kelly.
Let's mention that, because that to me doesn't seem like a guilty pleasure. So I just, before we talk about the other one, which I feel like... you know, there's more to discuss.
Okay, yeah.
Why did you pick Kelly's Heroes?
I took you at your word, really. I thought that was a slight... I would feel slightly guilty spending an afternoon watching that. but I think it is an excellent film. And also, I like the writer of it. I'm a big fan of Troy Kennedy Martin, who also wrote The Italian Job. And lots of other fantastic stuff like Edge of Darkness. But it's just a great film, and I've always got a weakness for heist films.
Have you ever had a conversation with someone that's gone, oh, that's terrible, what are you talking about? Like, what made you think it's possibly a guilty pleasure?
I've just never seen it in a list. Well, not that I've particularly looked. I've never seen a list of great films or anything.
Yeah.
Or
it might just always be number 11. You never know.
Yeah. I've never seen it edging out Apocalypse Now as the definitive war film of all time.
It's one of the few films that Don Rickles is in.
Yeah, he's very good at it. Yeah. He's the hustler in it. Yeah.
Well, more, I think... this is the first film, Bert, that you've picked that is a kind of current movie that is someone's guilty pleasure. And you picked, do you want to announce
Grimsby.
This? Grimsby. Now, this is weird. This has come up a couple of times over the last couple of months. It's been perceived as a film that flopped or failed. But I know so many people, particularly comedy writers, who love it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Even though it's... you know, the sort of a public opinion is, oh, that film didn't work.
Well, I don't know how it did in terms of audience, but it was certainly got some slaggings in the press, didn't
it? Yeah, I think so. But the one I've not actually seen it, probably because I've been affected by the opinion of it.
Right.
But the one clip I saw of it made me howl with laughter.
Well, you see, I saw it I hadn't read anything about it. Yeah. All I knew was that, Sacha Baron Cohen was in it. And, I wanted to film. I'd arranged to take my 17-year-old nephew out.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, it's got to be a film that he's going to like.
Mm-hmm.
Saw that, took him along, and literally hadn't read any of the advance reviews or anything.
Which is often
in fact, it's always the best way to see a film. And I just thought it was hilarious. I thought it was really, really funny. It was
Your nephew like it as well?
Yeah, he absolutely. Yeah. I mean, maybe partly I was kind of seeing it through his eyes. Yeah. He absolutely, wet himself. It was fantastic. But genuinely, it's full of fantastic set pieces, very, very gross.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I thought there was quite a lot of warmth in it as well. You see quite a lot of his family, and they present them as real sort of horrible northern chavs. But at the same time, you definitely know that he loves them, and they have a nice relationship.
Yeah, he's like a doting father
right? Yeah, and he really loves his brother. That's the whole sort of story of the film. So I just thought it was funny and I liked it. And then when the reviews came out, I thought, what? You know.
Was there a moment where you're like, maybe I saw a different film, or maybe I have a weird perception of things? Did you just go, too intellectual?
Exactly, I thought they're just being a bit too precious. Yeah, they should have just seen it for what it was, which was just a really funny, unpretentious film.
Where does it hold in his canon of work? What position do you think...
Well, it's very different, obviously, to the... because there's no hidden camera stuff.
Yeah.
But he's
done The Dictator, which was also a non-hidden camera thing, which...
I didn't see that.
And it feels like people are just not as interested in seeing him in a non sort of real-life situation comedy. And there is something, it's really hard to beat Borat, isn't it?
I mean, that's the thing. It's one of the funniest films of all time. It's just brilliant. I love them.
Do you think Borat will hold up in like another 10 years? Because will people still be as shocked by it, or do you think it was just really of the moment?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it relies so much on hidden camera. I mean, the joke where he's buying a car and he says, "I want to buy a car that will attract a woman who is shaved down there. What should I get? And the bloke immediately just says, a Pontiac. I don't know. I don't know whether that'll survive the years.
Surely.
I love that. Maybe that guy had been asked that question many times before. Yeah. Who knows? The Naked Wrestle is still... I've never been in a cinema where... for the 4 minutes after the scene finished, the audience are still laughing after that Naked Wrestle. It was, I mean, I don't think I've laughed that much since then.
But that's the other thing about, because a lot of the critics go along and it's like, you know, five sort of journalists other in a critics, really empty screening room. And they watch a film like that, and you're bound to have a bit of cynicism about you. But if you see it on a Friday night in a packed cinema... It's a totally different thing.
Also, I think the minute that you're watching something with the voice going, right, I've got to review this, what am I going to say? You're not watching something in an honest way. Now, I think you can do that, and if the film is so mind-blowingly brilliant that it doesn't necessarily affect your judgment. But when it's just a sort of crowd-pleasing, silly, crass comedy, and you're sitting there trying to think of a clever review, it's like it sort of kind of goes against each other.
Yeah.
Well, I need to see Grimsby. That's the upshot of this. You are another person who really liked it. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for coming. Have you got anything other than the Windsors coming up afterwards?
We're doing a lot of sketch shows now. We're doing Tracy Ullman's sketch show again, and David Williams got a sketch show, and Newsoids is back as well.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of sketches at the moment.
How long does that take to shoot? Newsoids.
That's got a long, long time. It's up and running now. They won't shoot it until I don't know, July, August, and then it'll be topical through.
It's kind of like animated. What sort of animation?
It is. They build actual electronically controlled puppets, and then they superimpose the eye and mouth movements onto it post. And they're little sort of Thunderbird size, about, you know, 2 feet high, I think, these puppets.
And how topical can you be on that show? Like, if it's due to go out on the Sunday... Was it a Sunday it went out?
I think it might be going out on a Saturday. I'm not sure.
What's the latest you could be writing jokes for?
Some sketches they did write up to the last
minute. I think they can go like 24 hours before, I think. Wow.
But a lot of them are in the bank before that.
Yeah. Do you like doing that kind of thing, or is there a pressure like, there's nothing funny's happened this week?
There's a little bit of that. It's a nice just other sort of bit of your palate to do. You know, so in a way, it's a relief from doing... Because obviously on the Windsors, you're so responsible for the story, for everything. Mm-hmm. So just to write a two-minute sketch can be a nice bit of light relief, you know.
And do you... I would assume I know the answer to this, but do you prefer writing for hire or creating your own work?
Oh, well, creating our own work.
But there is a sort of... when you're a gun for hire, there's some... I mean, it's not just about, we'll do that job for the money. It's, you know, obviously that's... You know, you've got to make a living. But I think you learn stuff from doing that. Which you can then apply... To the stuff that you create.
And we've never been snobby about sketches. I mean, you know, I love a good sketch. It's a thing of joy. So, you know, we've been lucky to work on some great ones. So.
You sounded like you were talking about wine or something. I love a good sketch.
Yeah. Love it. Good full-bodied sketch with
a nice good finish.
An 84 sketch, which would be the night in the clock news, I think. Well, we're going to end on your choice of song, George.
Oh.
Nice. Why don't you tell us a bit about this song?
Well, this is a RC choice, which is the main theme from the film Day for Night by Francois Truffaut, which I like very much. And I thought I'd pick it because the film's all about filmmaking. And it's a lovely piece of music. It is a classic. In fact, I was trying to find, for years, trying to find out where I could get it. And I had a tape of it and I played it to a
cassette.
And I had it in the car and I played it to this cellist mate of mine. And... I said, who did this? And he just goes, it's Baroque Pastiche. And I had another mate who just went, it's Baroque Pastiche, mate. And so I never knew what it was. And then when the internet rolled around, I was able to get hold of it.
And this is by George Delarue?
I believe so. I'm not sure. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Okay, well, thanks very much for being our guest today, guys.
A pleasure.
Good luck with the rest of the Windsors.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.